Coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare, and Jody Vittori, Senior Policy Advisor for Global Witness on Afghanistan Policy. She spent 20 years in the U.S. military, served in a number of countries, including Afghanistan, has received numerous military awards, including two Bronze Stars. To see part one of our conversation, actually our whole extended conversation with these two women, you can go to democracynow.org. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, our daily headlines and news alerts every day, you can text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. That's Democracy Now, no space, to 66866. And that does it for our broadcast. If you want to see the video, audio, podcast transcripts of all shows over the last 21 years, you can go to democracynow.org. Today, a very happy birthday to our general manager, Julie Crosby. It's a big one, Julie. All the best. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gadas-Diener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars. Our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Meadows, Anna Osbeck, Matt Ealy. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Unhappy about the current political regime? Want to do something about it? Something social justice related? But how do you find out about these things? Portland Resistance Calendar lets you know about a lot of these happening in the Portland area for the next week. It's a weekly podcast. It's a blog. It's a calendar. It's a floor cleaner. It's updated on Fridays. Learn more at kboo.fm/resist.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver. His stage show, An Evening with Dan Levinson, is an intimate evening of musical conversation that combines old-time fiddle, Appalachian banjo, stories and song in a storytelling format to tell the story of life in rural Appalachia and life on the road. Again, that's An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
And good morning. Here we are once again. Wednesday has rolled around again. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland, be with you until 9 o'clock. We just heard a little bit of Leo Kottke's version of Jefferson Airplane's Embryonic Journey. He's got a birthday coming up in a couple weeks. Anyway, so my guest this morning, unfortunately, had a family emergency and is not able to make it either by phone or in person. So I am going to read the piece that he was going to read and discuss from Counterpunch. I'll get to that in a second. First, something that caught my attention. Everybody has been rightfully outraged and horrified by the death and serious injuries caused by the person speeding in their car and hitting those people in Charlottesville a couple weekends ago. Somewhat less noticed has been the assault of 20-year-old DeAndre Harris, a young black man who was viciously beaten for an extended period of time by these white supremacists in a parking garage right next to the police station with a number of witnesses. And no arrests have been made in that case. It's been a couple weeks now. I'm just going to read really briefly from this article. Unfortunately, I didn't get where this came from. Written by Michael Sainato, S-A-I-N-A-T-O, on Counterpunch of yesterday. So you can, that's where it came from, Counterpunch. On August 12, five white supremacists were photographed and recorded on video beating 20-year-old DeAndre Harris in the midst of protests and counter-protests regarding a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee and the racist ideology behind this icon. Harris himself wrote on his GoFundMe page, "No law enforcement stepped in to help me. Once I was dragged off to some nearby steps, I was taken to the designated area for injured protesters and counter-protesters. My injuries were too extensive to be treated at the scene, so I was taken to the emergency room at Martha Jefferson Hospital. I was diagnosed with a concussion, an ulnar fracture, I believe that's the arm, and had to receive 8 staples in my head. I also have a laceration across my right eyebrow, abrasions on my knees and elbows, and a chipped tooth." That's a quote from his accounting of what happened. "The police did nothing during this violence, as did several witnesses to these events unfolding. Over a week since the assault on Harris went viral, and each of the five white supremacists who engaged in the attack have been doxxed, outed, and identified by social media with the help of New York Daily News columnist Sean King. Not a single arrest has been made. Michael Ramos of Marietta, Georgia, Michael Tubbs, Dan Borden of Mason, Ohio, are three of the five white supremacists involved in the assault who have been positively identified. It's been over a week since the incident, but no charges have been filed, nor have any of these individuals been detained by police. Harris's mother, the man who was beaten, has said her son is still receiving threats for the attack he suffered that went viral on social media. Zach Roberts, the photographer of the photo that went viral from the attack, was recently contacted by the FBI to discuss the incident, but has not been contacted by Charlottesville Police Department, despite pleading with officers at the scene of the crime. The Charlottesville Police Department have not returned requests for comments on the incident. Another victim of attacks from the rally, Tyler McGill, a University of Virginia employee, suffered a stroke last week that may be linked to injuries inflicted on him by white supremacists while protesting in Charlottesville. In contrast, 8 people have been arrested so far due to their involvement in taking down a Confederate statue in Durham, North Carolina, over the past week. The Durham Sheriff's Department issued a statement that each of the protesters face felony charges. They noted that they expect to make additional arrests related to the statue's removal. A clear-eyed understanding of our nation's systemic relationship to white supremacy reveals that the United States has consistently treated white supremacist terrorists with more sympathy and respect than civil rights activists, wrote Dr. Crystal Fleming in an op-ed for The Root on August 19th. The white supremacists who held the rally in Charlottesville have continued to expose their lack of decency toward other humans. Jason Kessler, the organizer of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, tweeted this past weekend, "Heather Heyer was a fat, disgusting communist. Communists have killed 94 million. Looks like it was payback time." In reference to Heather Heyer, the 32-year-old woman who was killed by a terrorist who drove his Dodge Charger into a crowd. Yeah, that was an article in Counterpunch called "Police Have Made No Arrests Over Charlottesville Assault of 20-year-old DeAndre Harris." So we're going to shift gears a little bit. Got a few other articles I printed off real quick when I realized that there was no chance that Jeffrey St. Clair would be joining us, unfortunately. As I said, he's got a family emergency that he's dealing with right now as we speak. So he wrote a piece on August 18th this past weekend, "To See or Not or to Not See." N-A-Z-I, "Trump's Moral Blind Spot is America's." And before I start, let me just give the number to call in with your contributions, questions, comments, 503-231-8187. That's the studio line, as differentiated from the front desk line, for those who might be unfamiliar with how it works here, KBOO Community Radio. So yeah, feel free after I get a ways into this to call in. It's kind of long. I probably won't get to read the whole thing. So we have entered the time of mock outrage. The press was shocked that armed neo-Nazis were marching through the streets of Charlottesville shouting "blood and soil" and "Jews will not replace us." Republicans were aghast that many of these thugs were wearing Trump's red "Make America Great Again" caps. Democrats were indignant that Republicans didn't call for Trump's head on a platter. Everyone felt very good about how bad they felt. In this national psychodrama, Trump plays the role of the great revealer. Trump has pulled back the curtains on the cesspool of American politics for the inspection of all but the most timid. Trump speaks the forbidden words that many other Americans secretly think. Trump utters these heresies self-righteously and without shame. Therefore, he must be punished for putting the system at risk. He must be lashed for his shamelessness. He must be castigated for exposing the sickness at the heart of the American project. Trump is Melville's confidence man. He offers his minions the chance to indulge in political taboos. But unlike Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, he is not a trickster or a quick change artist. All of his lies and temptations are at the service of his own vanity, and most are so transparent that even his most ardent devotees don't swallow them whole. Yet he rarely lies about how he feels, not for long anyway. His skin is too thin. Trump can't escape who he really is, and another politician, Jimmy Carter perhaps, this might be an endearing quality. With Trump, it is deeply unnerving. Trump's rapacity and bigotry strike too close to home. He reminds us that we haven't buried the worst of our past. Trump is a familiar character to most of the world. He is the unvarnished embodiment of the American bully, who has stalked the planet for the last century, taking what it wants and leaving corpses and ruin in its wake. There is in Trump no pretense to the humane, no guise of benevolence or cloak of empathy. He is the threatening figure he appears to be, which is, of course, exactly how you want your adversary to appear. The poor recognize Trump for what he is. He's the guy who collects the rent, who turns the water and electricity off, who spits at you when you ask for money for food, who sends your kid off to war while his goes big game hunting, who snitches your mom out to the cops for her OxyContin habit. They don't need any false words from Trump to heal their shock about the evil rampage in Charlottesville. They aren't shocked by Charlottesville. They've lived that reality most of their lives. And they aren't startled that the perpetrators have sympathizers in the government. That's the way it's always been on the mean streets of America. Now middlebrow America is getting a glimpse of itself through the mirror of its own bombastic, vindictive, and racist leader. He has fractured the rituals and conventions that desensitized most Americans from what our system is really all about. The elites fear Trump because he gives the game away. He personifies the reality they've been working for decades to conceal. The role of most presidents has been to comfort the nation when it recoils at a sudden view of its own depravity, from the My Lai massacre to Abu Ghraib, assuring the citizenry that the system isn't as malign as it appears. Trump pours acid on the wounds, as when he impertinently reminded the country that his two most revered founders were big-time slave owners. Trump's initial response to the Charlottesville Nazi Fest was one of the most honest statements of his presidency. No false pieties, no hollow condolences to the dead and injured, no fake denunciation of the racists whose support he craves and whose views he shares. With a wink and nod, he swiftly condemned generic hate and violence. Listen to what he said in last night in Arizona. That's my parentheses. Leaving the country to wonder how these sentiments squared with his remarks earlier in the week threatening to make North Korea, to nuke North Korea and invade Venezuela. When he returned to the cameras 2 days later to read the words that the political and media elites put in his mouth, Trump looked like he was making a hostage tape. He seethed as he spit out sentences against his will. You could almost see the steam rising as he stormed out of the room. You just knew he was going to blow. It took less than 24 hours. On Monday, Trump blew up Infrastructure Day 2 with an incandescent eruption of white rage, where he impetuously advanced a moral equivalency between Nazis, some of them armed with semi-automatic rifles, and the people amassed to confront them. During his rancid rant, Trump crassly used a tweet by Heather Heyer's mother, Susan Bro, as a prop to boost his own self-esteem, and then a few hours later, tweeted out a cartoon of a Trump train running over a CNN reporter. The man has class. People were quick to say Trump's presidency ended at that moment, as even squeamish CEOs started jumping ship. I'd argue that it's just begun. And again, I'm reading from To See or To Not See. Trump's moral blind spot is America's. We are now confronted with the most openly racist president since Woodrow Wilson, and he isn't going anywhere for the next few years. How naive did you have to be to think it was going to work out much different? What was the AFL-CIO doing on the president's manufacturing council to begin with? If you hadn't paid attention to his racist tactics as a landlord or his call to have the railroaded and innocent young black men known as the Central Park Five executed, there were hours of Trump tape from the Howard Stern show to document the moral character of the man. Did anyone really think Trump was capable of denouncing white racists with any kind of authenticity? For Trump to condemn Nazis is to condemn Daddy. He's frozen in a Freudian knot. It's instructive to realize that three of the last five U.S. presidents had fathers or grandfathers who were Nazi sympathizers. See Prescott Bush. And the sixth, Ronald Reagan, laid flowers on the graves of the Waffen SS. The GOP damage control strategy has been obvious. You must publicly denounce KKK and Nazis if you want to continue implementing racist policies and laws. And all but the most loyal Trumpites have fallen into line. The problem is that Trump's base isn't going with them. Indeed, there's little indication that Republican voters are bothered much by Trump's fulminations. Trump remains the great white hope. They want to see him fight and don't much care if he's throwing punches at Nancy Pelosi, Wolf Blitzer, or Mitch McConnell. Trump has tried to rally his forces by talking about the sanctity of American history and the cultural value of statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. He even suggests that the alt-left might soon be coming with a wrecking ball for the Washington Monument and Jefferson Memorial. Let it be so. But even Lee would have been a dissenter to Trump's cause. In an 1869 letter to a friend, Lee registered, as General Robert E. Lee, resisted movement in the southern states after the war to erect memorials to the rebels. I think it wise not to keep open the sores of war, Lee wrote, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife, to commit to oblivion the feelings engendered. Lee was lucky to have lived to have a say in the matter. President Andrew Johnson wanted the general tried and executed as a traitor. His neck was saved by Ulysses S. Grant. No good deed goes unpunished. Now Grant is known mostly for his tomb, which he ended up in after drinking more than Nixon in the final days. And Lee is mythologized as a reluctant warrior and honorable loser. He was neither. Grant was a hell of a writer, by the way. His memoirs, written while he was broke and dying of throat cancer, are the best of any president's. Not saying all that much, admittedly. Lee's request generally held sway until the turn of the century. The vast majority of Confederate memorials and statues went up after the infamous Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1896 and the subsequent rise of Jim Crow laws across the South. The Confederate monuments idolized by Trump and his retinue aren't solemn idols to a lost cause, but imposing symbols of the reassertion of white power. Trump himself has been somewhat less respectful of historical monuments when they've stood in his way. In 1979, Trump stunned the New York art world when he demolished two highly esteemed Art Deco friezes on the facade of the Bonwit Teller Building to clear the way for the construction of Trump Tower. And even now, he has ordered his Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, to develop plans to gut protections for as many as 27 national monuments, from the Siskiyous to the Bear's Ears. For their part, the Democrats, who almost universally back the torch-bearing fascists in Ukraine, have been grousing about Trump's use of the term alt-left. But the president swiped it from Democratic Party operatives such as Neera Tanden, Joan Walsh, and Joy Reid, who have been using the expression to smear Bernie Sanders and his ragtag gang of Sandernistas as left-wing zealots bent on taking over the Democratic Party. These same liberal functionaries are now demanding that Trump fire Steve Bannon to prove he's serious about confronting races. Of course, that's now a fait accompli, my intervention there. By the same measure, shouldn't the Democrats expel all of their own members who voted for the racist Clinton crime bill, which has arguably inflicted more damage on Black America than any legislation since the Fugitive Slave Act? This would, of course, include Bernie Sanders, who remains unrepentant about his vote. Well, I've got about a page left, so I might as well go finish. I know we've got a caller waiting. But if you had only one target to set your sights on, why waste it on Bannon? On foreign policy and economics, Bannon tends to be the sanest voice in the padded cell known as the Oval Office. Check out his fascinating interview with Robert Kuttner in the crusty liberal rag American Prospect, where Bannon inveighs against the hawks in the White House, dismisses the alt-right as losers and clowns who need to be crushed, and rules out military action against North Korea, going so far as to say that he'd support removing U.S. troops from South Korea in exchange for a verifiable freeze in the North's nuclear weapons camp program. Surely, when it comes to racist policies, the greatest villain in the Trump ecosystem is the living Confederate monument, J. Beauregard Sessions. But the Democrats have flocked to defend Sessions, first because they want him to stay on as Attorney General to protect Mueller's Russia probe from getting pink slipped by Trump, and second because he used the magic word terrorism when describing the killing of Heather Heyer. That was easy. Now watch how many Blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans Sessions locks up over the next 3.5 years. With Bannon out, the efficiency experts from the Pentagon and Goldman Sachs, now running the Trump White House, may actually be able to put their plans into action. Duck and cover. Predictably, in the post-Charlottesville fever that's been a rush to find a legislative fix to curtail future noxious gatherings of the American Nazis. These knee-jerk maneuvers will almost certainly pose more of a threat to the Constitution than the white power movement. If they criminalize hate, what will happen to those of us who hate war makers, bankers, oil companies, home foreclosures, killer cops, and white supremacists? Any laws enacted in the name of Charlottesville will restrict the political activities of the left more than the far right, for the simple reason that the government has nothing to fear from the far right. See the aftermath of Clinton's Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, passed after the Oklahoma City bombing and the Patriot Act. Already the Congress is moving to outlaw boycotts of Israel. How easy will it be to apply the same censorious template to quash protests against clear cuts on national forests, nuclear plants, animal slaughterhouses, ICE raids, drone operations, or police violence? It's a dead certainty that the biggest beneficiary of the horrors that took place in Master Jefferson City will be the most lethally racist institution in the country, the police, who will see their powers and budgets increase. In Charlottesville, it was hard to tell the cops for the neo-Nazis. Swaddled in their black stormtrooper gear, the police held back, watching passively as goons with shields and clubs flailed away at protesters. It wasn't difficult to detect where their sympathies resided. There are probably more white supremacists in the New York Police Department than the neo-Nazi Vanguard America, which claims only 200 members. On one day alone this month, August 4th, 2017, 9 Americans in 7 different states were killed by police. I didn't read anything in the New York Times about that atrocity. Perhaps this kind of state-sanctioned racist violence is now much too familiar to even warrant a headline. And again, that was To See or Nazi, that's spelled N-A-Z-I, Trump's Moral Blind Spot is America's by Jeffrey St. Clair, longtime critic of hypocrisy and moral blindness by both right and so-called left, especially the institutional left in the Democratic Party and the big environmental groups, big labor, and elsewhere. And he is also a managing editor, I believe, of Counterpunch, a fine website to check out. And I believe we've got a caller patiently waiting. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Paul. Yes, that was pretty brilliant, what you just read by St. Clair. I would have mentioned Bannon's particular brand of racism and neo-Nazism, but I thought what he said about Bannon's positions was mostly true. In any case, I didn't call about that. I called because maybe you already said something about this, but Trump keeps saying he's against neo-Nazis and so forth, and yet he spoke up in defense of Jeffrey Lord, the CNN reporter who was fired for tweeting a Nazi salute, apparently. Did you hear about that?
I did not.
Yeah, I heard about that, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. If you look online, you'll see it. But it's just yet another of the sleights of hand and the shell game that he plays with people. You know, feigning. He said this in front of the Phoenix crowd. He was playing to their sympathies, you know. In any case,
did you hear that whole speech?
I couldn't tolerate even a few words of it. I every time his face comes on the TV, I push the mute button. I can't handle him. I know maybe I should listen, but I've heard a lot of that dreck. I heard a lot of primary speeches. I know what he's going to say. It causes me so much distress emotionally. I can't take it anymore. So I just allow myself to hear it through people like you. And thank you. Thank you for being on the job at this very, very difficult time.
Well, I didn't actually hear the whole thing myself. I heard bits and pieces, but sounded like a real gem. Maybe some other people out there heard it and want to comment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you again, Paul, for your show. I love it. Okay,
all right. Thank you so much for calling in. And it's 503-231-8187. Wonder if, I don't know. I think sometimes one of the positive things I think can be accomplished by programs like this is just to keep putting out the information, like that the Charlottesville police have made no arrests over the assault, blatant, brutal assault by 5 white supremacists of 20-year-old DeAndre Harris in a parking garage there during the events of a couple weekends ago in Charlottesville, Virginia. They even have names and known faces. Nothing's been done. I think calling the Charlottesville Police Department would not be a bad idea. I don't happen to have that number handy. I'm sure it's easy enough to look up. Can keep fighting for justice, if nothing else. I got another article here, Blood and Soil, Hey Joe, Where Are You Going? Again, on the Counterpunch website by Vern Loomis. What's in it for you? I mean, I get it for the big dogs. They already got something going, like pulling your strings, for starters. It maybe don't not sound like much, but multiplied by 100 or 1,000 times, and it gets to be pretty heady stuff, if you know what I mean. They're the man. They get to be the alphas right now without doing nothing but talking tough and pulling strings. They got the talk, and they get the look. But you, Joe, what about you, the average Joe? Will you get to have the look? What's in it for you? Do you know what's up ahead? Like, what if it really works? Or like, what if it don't? What you do want something to come of it, right? You're not a rebel just for kicks, are you? I mean, look at what can happen. People get hurt, even die. Maybe even could be you. So you got to think it's important, right? What's the best thing that can happen? Or like, what about the worst? I mean, where do you want it to go? Are you really ready? Because you're going to have to live with it, you know? If they really do make it happen, and all those others that don't belong are gone, what's it going to look like anyhow? Are you thinking kind of like a whole new country? Or maybe make a huge commune thing somewhere? Probably won't be that. Sounds way too hippie or commie or something. I guess you could do it, though, and just call it something else like camp or compound. Sounds better, right? It could even be in the woods with guns and lots of hunting and stuff. And you could drive those little camo carts through the trails and all that. Wouldn't have to be hippie at all. Wait, maybe I got no imagination yet. I bet it's going to be way bigger than just that. Like, maybe a whole state? What are you going to name it? One of those German-sounding names would be so cool. How about Ich Traum, or maybe Wuchs Traum, or something like that? Whatever you call it, it's really going to be awesome with all the pure bloods together. So there's got to be some walls, right, to keep the others out. That'll sure keep some of the average Joe busy for a while. Unless you get the Mexicans to do it. They're going to have to pay them, though. But probably won't be all that much. And, you know, I just thought of something. Maybe it could even be a prison work kind of thing for the ones who break in and dilute the blood and smuggle drugs and stuff, if you know what I mean. Wouldn't they hardly have to pay those hombres nothing at all? I mean, I know there's some good ones down there, but you might as well get something out of the bad ones for all the trouble. Speaking of blood, that makes me think of something. Are you going to check it? I mean, to make sure. They got those test things now, you know, where you can just spit or something and send in to find out what you are. So is everybody going to do that thing just to make sure? But hey, what if you don't pass? Would you just get kicked out? Or say, maybe, what if you almost pass, but not quite? Maybe you can still get to stay in, but in a special place and do special work or something like that. But shoot, if they did do it like that, would you still get to have a girlfriend in there? I could keep reading, but this is kind of funny, kind of grim, kind of ironic. Blood and Soil, Hey Joe, Where You Going? By Vern Loomis on Counterpunch. And we're waiting for you to call in to comment on this and other things I've been reading. 503-231-8187. You know, I think of that kind of thing when I talk to those so-called alt-writers at the various demonstrators they've been having here in the Portland area, with the libertarians and the Proud Boys and the others. They kind of got to know me. I don't know if any of them actually listened to the show. I told them about my show on KBOO. I don't think I've had any call in yet. Kind of be interesting to have a discussion about, you know, how pure they think their blood is, about where they really think this is all going. If they, you know, get to run the zoo, as Dr. Zeus said. But yeah, I don't really want to hear my voice. I'm sure some of you out there have some things to share about all this that's going on and more. 503-231-8187. Where are we all headed? What do you think? Where is it all going to end? What blind spots, what moral blind spots do you have? I really feel that in some ways, all of us, at least us Euro-Americans, have more in common, whether we're left or right, than we have different. After all, we're all heirs of the great vicious American project that has led us to this sorry pass for all of the, you know, people think that does the good outweigh the bad in the end? I think it's becoming increasingly evident that there's really nothing that's going to salvage this American project other than, I don't know, abandoning it, completely revamping it, revolutionizing it. I don't know. What's your vision of what could possibly reclaim the viciousness at the heart of America? What are your illusions that you continue to hang on to that you think you need to examine? Are we really that different? I really speak for myself as a white Euro-American. Of course, you know, many of us are bought into this, the illusions of the American empire. And are we that tired now that we're just going to go back, continue this war with Afghanistan? Are our energies that depleted that we are not able to muster resistance? There's so many fronts we seem to be fighting upon. It does get tiring, I know. Anyway, I'd like to hear what you have to say. 503-231-8187. Otherwise, I'm going to continue reading from some more stuff that I've found online, mostly on Counterpunch. My guest was going to be Jeffrey St. Clair. Unfortunately, he had a family emergency, so he wasn't able to come on the air with me. Got another article here. Is America Headed for a New Kind of Civil War? By Robin Wright. The recent unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, after a white supremacist rally has stoked some Americans' fears of a new civil war. A day after the brawling and racist brutality and deaths in Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe asked, "How did we get to this place?" The more relevant question after Charlottesville and other deadly episodes in Ferguson, Charleston, Dallas, St. Paul, Baltimore, Baton Rouge, and Alexandria, and elsewhere, and Portland, Oregon, is where the United States is headed. How fragile is the Union, our republic, and a country that has long been considered the world's most stable democracy? The dangers are now bigger than the collective episodes of violence. The radical right was more successful in entering the political mainstream last year than in half a century, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported in February. The organization documents more than 900 active and growing hate groups in the United States. America's stability is increasingly an undercurrent in political discourse. Earlier this year, I began a conversation with Keith Mines about America's turmoil. Mines has spent his career in the U.S. Army Special Forces, the United Nations, and now the State Department, navigating civil wars in other countries, including Afghanistan, Colombia, El Salvador, Iraq, Somalia, and Sudan. He returned to Washington after 16 years to find conditions that he had seen nurture conflict abroad now visible at home. It haunts him. In March, Mines was one of several national security experts whom Foreign Policy asked to evaluate the risks of a second civil war. With percentages, Mines concluded that the United States faces a 60% chance of civil war over the next 10 to 15 years. Other experts' predictions range from 5% to 95%. The sobering consensus was 35%, and that was 5 months before Charlottesville. That's from Is America Headed for a New Kind of Civil War by Robin Wright. Came out a week ago. And we've got Bob. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello.
Everything like most people are with this new fascism or new heavy push to the right. But I had two quotes that I have liked for a long time. Probably both of these people had their own faults, but one by Winston Churchill and one by a Roman senator named Cicero. And since I like history so much, and I think one of our biggest problems in the country is people don't know history, the right history. And my calling is triggered by a report I just heard on NPR that in Arizona they passed a law some time ago that purges the real history from the books if it disparages another group, i.e. white people. So, you know, they're messing with the history books and revising it, which is rather ironic because that's what Trump is saying that people are doing with the Confederate statues. But anyway, the two quotes are, I really like them. Cicero, who was, as I said, a Roman senator and probably a jerk in some ways, he said, "Not to know what happened before one was born is to remain a child. And I think that's one of the big problems we have, is people are just kind of, they don't have a historical rudder to figure anything out. The other one that's kind of amusing, and you can interpret it the way you want, by Churchill is really good. He had an American mom, I believe, and a British dad. He said, Americans always do the right thing after they've exhausted every other option. And it blows my mind that I'm pushing 70 years old and still, we're still dealing with the same issues that I realized when I was 14, 15, 16. So anyway, thank you for the work you do, and maybe those two quotes will provoke.
Well, that's because nothing's really changed.
Take care.
Okay, thank you for calling. I would say that's because nothing has fundamentally changed. We've put a gloss on some things, but really, I think the dark heart of the American project remains fundamentally the same. So anyway, let's go to our next caller. I believe Mike. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I just want to remind people to get on your cameras, get on your phone cameras, upload, download, put on your memory cards and mail them pictures of these racist, terroristic, you know, hate-filled, you know, fear-driving, fear-driven, ignorant trucks running around, get their license plate numbers. I don't think it's necessary to get their faces, but because that might be dangerous as well, but get their license plates, send them to the authorities, send them to the Southern Poverty Law Center, send them to Intifada, send them to people that can actually do some good with it, and put these people in their place, and anyway, get on it, people, please. And been doing it for a while. Clark County up here, Vancouver, north of Vancouver, is a hotbed. Look on the Southern Poverty Law Center site. Just don't take my word for it. It's a hotbed for KKK and so forth, and a lot of ignorant folks up here. That's the reason why some of them moved here.
Do you know any of their names?
Excuse me?
Do you know any of their names?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can go on the website and find out some of the, like, for instance, the organizer of the awful hate protest, hate speech thing down in Portland.
Oh, Joey Gibson.
You know, or so ago. Yeah. And there's some wonderful bloggers that are reporting on this. But that's just a few names. And it goes out and out and out. Of course, the sheriff department out here has its infiltration as well. All you got to do is hang out, maybe undercover, at some of the shooting ranges where they practice, and just record stuff and maybe take a few pictures if you can, or at least get names and go undercover. I've been there enough times to overhear the racist blah blah blah, and it's just a social thing for them, and it makes them feel part of a group, and fairly pathetic, like, you know, the human condition can be if we allow it. So get on it, people. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. All right, we got another caller. Quartz, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. My comments on what you've been reading and stuff like that, where's our future, where are we going? And the last caller mentioned, you know, history being rewritten and stuff like that. And I think that's, like, a huge part of it, that just what America is, why America's here, and who we all actually are, like, in respect to, like, what America actually is, I think is a very confused thing where people think that we have power when we clearly don't, and we never have. And just one other thing I wanted to say is studying, like, the old protests back from the Martin Luther King days and stuff like that, and student nonviolent coordinating committee and stuff like that, they used to, like, do the passive nonviolent resistance where they just sit there and take the hits or whatever, but, like, they were like super respectful about it and stuff like that. And I just kind of wish and hope that, you know, all the people who choose to protest, I personally don't go out to any protest because I understand the duality, and that once you set yourself up as the polar opposite of something else, it only further reinforces that thing to want to make a statement. But if I were to choose to go out there, I'd just sit there and don't say anything. Like, just sit there in silence. And if they come all crazy with clubs and whatever, it's like, you know, are you willing, what are you willing to die for? Like, you know, going back to that old history of the battles and the wars and the this and that, and it's just like, you know, what are people willing to die for? Versus, like, what are they willing just to go out and scream and yell for? And I think if, you know, the people who chose to go out to protest were to just go out there and just sit on the ground and just not say anything. And when the other sides come up, you know, just take those hits or whatever and let everybody else on the news and the media, you know, post the pictures and, you know, let the world decide, you know, what's despicable behavior. But that's just my opinion. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, that's one point of view. Well, thank you very much. Let's go right to our next caller. Frances, you're on the air.
Hi. I believe we need some serious truth and reconciliation on a national forum. I don't know how that will ever happen. I don't know that this president will even consider it. But
well, I think that's pretty. That's a given, isn't it?
There's a lot of pain amongst people and oppression, and I feel that the real enemy is the oppression, and I blame that on the corporate criminal justice system and the corporate warmongers. And I think that first article you read, there's a lot of valid points in it, and that's the thing that gets the media does perpetrate conflict. That's how they make their news. That's how they make their money. So they exaggerate different things that people say to inflame rather than talk about what's really going on. I think that, you know, mass incarceration is probably one of the most nefarious things we've done in a long time. And as you mentioned earlier, that got a big boost when Clinton was president.
Definitely fully bipartisan, that's for sure.
Right. And my question is, and I've been pondering this for a long time, trying to figure out how to get it to be represented to the Supreme Court. Can you put a corporation in prison?
Can you put who?
A corporation in prison.
Unfortunately, I don't think their personhood extends that far.
Right, so because they are not people. So I don't know why we keep allowing these people that are financing these campaigns and praying for people like that shyster to be president, who is just playing on people's fears and emotions.
Well, it's a question of power. It's a question of power.
Definitely. So how is it that a corporation has personhood? I don't, you know, fair is fair. We should use the 14th Amendment, as the corporations did, to get that status in the first place and turn it right back on them.
Well, if we get the power.
If you cannot send a corporation to prison for one of their nefarious acts, then they are not a person, and we need to stop allowing them to have all that power.
Right. Well, it remains
so
a question of power.
We need the Supreme Court to figure out a way to do that.
Right. Well, we need to get the power. So how do we gather the power together? That's a good question.
They have too much.
It's true. I won't deny it.
And the people can protest all they want to, but those corporations have the power to control the militias and the police and everything. So I got to revisit that and figure out a way.
All right.
You guys take care.
Thank you for calling. Okay. Before we go to John and then Tim, coming up this morning, Cable at 9, Political Perspectives digs into the vault and presents archival recordings of the late great comedian and civil rights activist Dick Gregory. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Recovery Zone talks to community activists Paul Cienfuegos and Eva Hamilton about the launch of Community Rights U.S. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, should you choose to be informed and involved, and we could always use your support and assistance. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate for one way to contribute and become a member if you are not already. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland. I was going to just reference really quickly, we're talking about the past, something I've talked about a lot on the show, you know, revising the past, controlling the past. It's called Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History by Michelle Rolfe Trouillot, a Haitian. It's a pretty heavy-duty book, well worth the read if you're into this sort of thing. Anyway, Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History by Michelle Rolfe, R-O-L-P-H, Trouillot, T-R-O-U-I-L-L-O-T. I may read a little bit from it, but we've only got 10 minutes left, so let's go to our next caller. John, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I want to talk a little bit about the statuary problem.
Yeah.
And put that kind of in a context. I mean, there have been various periods of history where there's been destruction of statuary. We're talking the iconography thing in the Byzantine Empire. We're talking about what happened. Have you ever been to England and seen the churches, the Gothic churches, where the Protestants knocked out all the stained glass? You know, then you have things like what the Taliban did. And so there's always been an attempt to obliterate unpleasant images that one culture thought existed in their past. So I have a feeling that the statuary ought to all be put in museums and not destroyed.
I don't think I haven't heard personally anyone publicly advocating destroying them.
Well, no, they've been talking about tearing them down. But I mean, we know that that was done, you know, like in Stalinist Russia. You know, in other words, there are whole junkyards full of Stalin stuff in Russia, Stalin and Lenin. So whenever there's a monumental statuary, there's always an impulse to get rid of it as well. But I'd like to throw one other thing out, is that those statues, you know, their statues were put in from 1890 to probably 1920, 1930, and they were a revival of this romantic vision of the Confederacy. And I think we all agree on that.
Well, they were, I think, more a direct reminder to Africans, African Americans, of the reassertion of white power.
Yeah, there was that, but there was something else that happened, which is that in the war of the Spanish-American War, the First World War, and the Second World War, there was an attempt to reintegrate the white Southern soldiers into the American Army. A very important thing that happened. Thousands and thousands of men, because the military career was always considered an honorable career in the South, and so you got many thousands of people, and the irony could be this, that if you think about it, is that how many Southern boys died fighting fascism and Nazism?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, it's always a double-edged sword, if you'll pardon the pun. And so, so while it was also a put-down of the black population, I mean, it was an attempt to reassert the ruling class of the South, but it was also the thing that reintegrated the South into being Americans in the patriotic sense. Now, whether you like that or not,
well, I think I can see various ways of doing that. Being, you know, redistributing the wealth, so that they actually were more fully included And doing away with the plantation system.
Economic story is a totally different story. But I'm just talking about what happened as far as the romanticism and how it you ended up with people like General Patton in the U.S. Army because the South was reintegrated into the American Army. Now, they could have included
African Americans, and there would have been actually a lot, possibly even more African Americans. There's always choices.
That's a more recent thing. That's all post World War II. I mean, that's when Truman integrated the.
Right. What I'm saying is, you're saying that there was a way of reintegrating the Southern soldiers. Well, they could have integrated.
But those we could have. So there are the whole.
Right. Well, these are choices. These are political choices. These are cultural, social, political choices.
Yeah, but the problem is the political choices are always made in the context of whatever exists at the time. And at that time, there was this sort of Anglo-Saxon hegemony over the world. If you ever want to see something that will show you that, look at the film. Of Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill on a British battleship singing the hymns you have to read the whole history.
Let's talk about the reality. Reconstruction really was changing. I mean, you know, that's kind of a passive.
And it was all undone.
Isn't that kind of a passive way of looking at reality? That's the way it was. So that's the way things went. It's like what happened was there was an actual attempt to do some kind of changing the playing field in the South,
right.
which was Reconstruction. That was viciously put down.
Completely backed off of that.
And part of it was the reassertion that using the statues and the images of the as you call it the Romantic South as a way of reasserting that white power. I mean,
Right. All I'm saying is that it's got a multiplicity of factors. Anyway,
fair enough.
They should just put all the statuary in a museum somewhere.
I think we can agree on that. Well, listen, we got another couple callers, and we only got a couple minutes left, but thanks.
Okay, well, anyway, you're running a very good show. There are a lot of issues.
Okay, we got to go. We got another couple callers before we end. Thank you very much. All right, let's go to Tim. You're on the air.
Oh?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm calling up about what to do about the Nazis and the fascists. And I just read Mein Kampf for most of it, and it's really clear if you look into Hitler's thinking, the way he organized his groups and stuff, that violence was an integral part of it. Violence and fear, right? The only way to get rid of the Nazis and the fascists, in my opinion, is to meet them with overwhelming force and crush them before they get a chance. So that means every time they have a meeting, we have five times as many people. Every time they have a letter to the editor, we swamp the paper with letters. Every time they try to outreach, they are crushed.
How about this? We only have a couple minutes. How about if we actually out-organize them? It seems like we're still caught in this somewhat of a reactionary cycle, and there isn't still enough.
All we need to organize is about 1-2% of the left. Well, those who are willing to go out there, confront, and if necessary, physically use violence.
Right, but the problem is, as Jeffrey St. Clair points out, that there's likely more, fascist sympathizing people in police departments across the country than actually in a lot of these kind of small. Organized hate groups that exist. So, how do you organize against the fascist sympathizing police? That'll take more than 1% of the population.
That's true, but right now I'm just focusing on the organized Nazi fascist groups. But you're right. There's a whole ocean of underground fascist sympathizers in this country.
Well, it's the system itself was built on those foundations.
It is a better way.
Fair enough. Well, we got to go. We're just about out of time. So thank you so much for calling, Tim and John and everybody else who called this morning on Wednesday Talk Radio. I guess we had one more caller, but go ahead, George. You only have like 30 seconds. Hello?
Are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, great show. You know, this is, I'm with the Pacific Green Party. I just want to applaud you on bringing this to light. You know, there's so much on my mind. It's very, very interesting. I think we're in a cultural war right now. I don't think it can really be debatable. And some of us on the Green Party have been calling Counterpunch sucker punch because they just keep swinging wide left hooks and bashing the Green Party. They came in for Cobb down in California, and now there was another guy.
You're opening up a can of worms that we're not going to be able to get into because we only have 15 seconds left. Call a little bit earlier next time if you're going to have a point that needs to be further gotten into. Thank you so much for calling, though. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. Be back next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. The Hawthorne Street Fair, now in its 34th year, features music, activities for kids and adults alike, entertainment, local businesses, and community vendors. Again, that's the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th, from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's political perspectives today, digging into the vault, and we'll present